2-2.
The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Desmond Tutu.
So this is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott, and with me as always is Uncle Ian. Uncle Ian, how are you feeling?
Scott, I'm looking forward to covering Mexico tonight.
I think ever since we started this whole concept, going to Mexico, covering the Aztecs is something that I've been very, very keen to do. And here we are, finally, 2.5 years later. So let's do it. Today's episode, Montezuma II up against Porfirio Diaz, the Aztec emperor, and the seven-term president of Mexico. So, Uncle Ian, let's start with Montezuma. Born in 1466 on the island of Tenochtitlan in what is today Mexico City. Montezuma was king of the great and powerful Aztec Empire, most famous for his encounter with another empire from across the sea. So, is Montezuma a victim or a hero or yet another villain? So Montezuma is an Aztec, so let's start with them. They spoke the Nahuatl language, and the word Azteca meant people from Aztlan, which is the Aztec homeland, which is not in Mexico, but is now Utah and Nevada. So border control seems to be a long-standing issue in this part of the world because they cross down into the Valley of Mexico around Texcoco. The previous great civilization there had collapsed, so the new arrivals successfully bullied and displaced the native people there. These migrations slash invasions occurred in waves. And Montezuma's people, called the Mexica, were the last to arrive, and they came in about 1250. Of course, the Mexica will eventually give their name to the country of Mexico. So the Mexica, they mixed with the locals and they joined up with the local Coahuacan people. And the Mexica asked the local ruler for his daughter, the princess, for a prestigious ceremony. And the Mexica then killed and flayed her in a sacrifice to the gods. And then their priest wore the skin of the princess at a festival with the local ruler. Uncle Ian, how do you think that went down with the locals?
I don't think that's a good way to build up community relations.
No, this is why cultural competence is so important. Because you need to understand the customs of other cultures in case they plan on skinning your princess daughter.
It's not the sort of thing you're going to forget in a hurry.
No. So for some reason, they were no longer welcome and they fled to an island in the middle of Lake Texcoco, which becomes the city of Tenochtitlan.
Building a city on a lake was pretty much the only option they had left.
Over 200 years, they built this power base there and this great city of Tenochtitlan. So in 1431, the Mexica, with two other city-states, the Texcoco and the Tlacopan, formed a triumvirate. Uncle Ian, we haven't seen a triumvirate since our discussions of ancient Rome. Indeed. And they overthrew the previous dominant city-state. This is the situation that Montezuma is born into in 1466. The Mexica have become the leading city in a triumvirate controlling a vast empire in the Valley of Mexico. The client city-states paid tribute to the triumvirate and Mexica received the largest share. These regular tribute requirements almost always included slaves. And this forces client city-states into waging their own wars against more distant neighbors to take prisoners and send the Mexica as slaves. Montezuma inherited the throne from his uncle in 1502 to become emperor. Although it wasn't really a throne, it was actually a reed mat, which is less impressive, and sometimes called the eagle mat, which sounds good, but if you walk into the palace and your emperor is sitting on a mat...
You expect a throne.
Yes, but cultural competence, very important. Mm. There was no primogeniture in Aztec culture, so the firstborn son wouldn't inherit the throne or eagle mat. And there were many sons to choose from on Khoiyan because the kings and nobles married multiple women from various city-states. So in theory, the prince that would inherit the throne would be the son of the primary wife. And the primary wife was basically the princess of the next most powerful city-state. And so if that city-state suffers a loss in prestige, then the king would just start taking an interest in his other wives and other sons. So there's no Henry VIII style problem of a lack of sons, but the princes did regularly form alliances and kill each other. So there is that problem. And so in the hope of appearing in this podcast, Montezuma centralized power in his city of Tenochtitlan and in himself. They were still technically in that triple alliance, but he wanted his family to rule in the allied city of Texcoco. Now, the heir to Texcoco came to Tenochtitlan to sing for the court and made the mistake of giving an offensive performance. This was a gift to Montezuma, who had the excuse he needed to have him strangled to death. He then bribed the dead heir's brothers and named his own nephew as heir to the city of Texcoco.
So was his singing that bad?
So during Montezuma's reign, he actually managed to double the size of the empire, which is a very impressive feat, and he did this by imposing permanent military garrisons throughout the empire to expand it. So it's a bit like the Roman legions, let's say, just posted all throughout the empire. And with the influx of wealth and slaves, Tenochtitlan became remarkably beautiful. Flowered gardens overflowed from the roofs, and stylish buildings lined the organized grid of streets. Exotic birds flew overhead and were kept in cages for their songs, and bridges and canals connected the island to the shores of the lake. And a two-story aqueduct provided the city with fresh water. And they didn't have grey water plumbing, but the people's urine was captured and transported in giant clay pots and recycled for the ammonia which they'd used for leather goods. So it was a very clean city, very well ordered, very impressive. And at the center of the city were the two great pyramids of Tenochtitlan, a temple and a palace. So in his palace, Montezuma had a zoo in his royal gardens. And it didn't just contain the many exotic animals, but also human beings with congenital abnormalities like dwarves, etc. Which isn't very politically correct, Uncle Ian. I don't think you get away with that now. They don't have Peter Dinklage in San Diego Zoo.
Yeah, but he's got a fairly big army at his back, so I don't think he'd be the one we'd be putting in the zoo.
Yes, the Lannisters will be looking after him, I imagine. The population kept growing, partly due to immigration, attracted by the wealth of the city, but mostly because the women of conquered cities would be captured and would serve as concubines. Women in Aztec culture were generally respected and their role was seen as complementary to the role of men. However, these prisoners of war became slaves with no status or future. It would later create a logistical problem because so many noble children were being born to the many wives and concubines that there weren't enough commoners to fund them. So Montezuma himself had 100 kids, and so the social pyramid became more like a square.
They're very top heavy.
Very top heavy. And it's like the problem we have now, Uncle Ian, of the aging population. And you've got too many old people, not enough young people to fund their pensions. So Montezuma, he fixed this. He created a classification system to reduce the number of those recognized as nobility. So it's like the government trying to redefine what an old person is by making the retirement age 85 or something, like Macron in France. I think the French are trying to raise it from about 40 to 50. The French. Being an Aztec slave wasn't fun, Uncle Ian. I can tell you that for free. But it was preferable to the alternative,
which was being a human sacrifice.
Which was being a human sacrifice. It was common amongst the Native American peoples. The Aztecs believed they must offer a sacrifice to keep the sun rising, or they'd all die. They believed that they were currently living the age of the fifth sun, and this son was created by a human sacrifice. So they quickly started sacrificing prisoners of war instead of their own people, because I think they thought, oh, that's better. As their power grew, so did the number of sacrifices, allowing them to build a great pyramid of skulls in the center of Tenochtitlan. Over time, the sacrifices became less for religious reasons and more of an instrument of fear used to control the cities that they conquered. And the sacrifices were initially monthly, except for child sacrifices, which occurred yearly. By the end of Montezuma's reign, all of the priests of Tenochtitlan had to work full-time preparing, conducting, and cleaning up after the human sacrifices. Montezuma himself participated in the ceremonies. The victim would be placed on the sacrificial stone, and then they'd cut him open and remove his heart. Montezuma's favorite form, however, was forcing these sacrifices to fight each other for their lives, and then Montezuma would also kill the winner.
What, just to see the look on the winner's face?
It's a bit harsh, isn't it? Oh, you, congratulations, you won. Oh, great. What's your reward? It's to also die.
Yeah, denial of procedural fairness.
I should mention other elements of Aztec culture. It was brutal. Another example of that is the young soldiers would stab their penises with thorns to cause droplets of blood to nourish the earth and please the gods. And it was also done to kind of prove how tough they were. Do you do that in your spare time, Uncle Ian?
I'm glad I never joined the army.
Mm. They also had beautiful poetry, which lamented the tough life of the slave and the tragedy of deaths from war. And they were also quite a sentimental culture. One peculiar custom they had was to bury the newborn child's umbilical cord under the house by the fireplace. So, Uncle Ian, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, the Spanish will enter the chat. So, Uncle Ian, tell me how the Spanish decide they want to conquer these Aztec people. It sounds like a terrible idea.
Well, it was certainly terrible for the Aztecs. In 1492, Columbus landed in the Caribbean. On his subsequent voyages, explored what he thought was Asia, but of course we know it was the coast of the Caribbean, the southern coast and the western coast. That was followed more officially in 1517 by Grijalva, who landed on the Yucatan Peninsula and the Caribbean port of Veracruz. That opened up the Aztec Empire to potential as a trading partner. Cortes was authorized by the court of Spain to find where all this gold was and open up a trading link. And so in 1519, he's landed at Veracruz with 550 Europeans, not really an army. They had the grand total of 16 horses. Montezuma knew when the Spanish landed because of his relationships with the local tribes. When he heard about the horses and when he heard about these funny sticks that could shoot fire, he got fairly apprehensive. And so he actually got quite indecisive. Originally, he sent magicians to meet the Spaniards, hoping to be able to put a spell on them.
Is this your card?
One of the things that I don't quite understand is that Montezuma sent gifts of gold to the Spaniards to encourage them to go away. If I was a gold-hungry Spaniard, that wouldn't encourage me to go away. That would only encourage me to keep marching through the jungle to find out where there was more gold.
They met with the Mayans, and the Mayans said, oh, actually, we don't have that much gold here, but do you know who has heaps of gold? Absolutely heaps of those Aztecs up there. You should go check those guys out. You should leave as soon as possible and go there.
Very clever by the Mayans.
And meanwhile, a girl with an unknown name from a village in the outskirts of the Aztec Empire was taken into slavery and transported on a canoe and sold as a slave to the Mayans. Now, Uncle Ian, we can't get too distracted by the Maya, but can I tell you a Maya fun fact?
Please.
It's actually a disturbing fact. The Mayans took a lot of slaves, and the reason, you might be familiar with, the Mayans ran a successful textile trade. And so the slaves were imported to work the cotton fields.
Unfortunately, that's a business model that was perpetuated.
So this foreign girl with the unknown name becomes a Mayan common household slave. But she would become the most famous woman in Mexican history, perhaps North American history, because of her relationship with Hernan Cortes and his Spanish conquistadors. And this girl with the unknown name, she's one of these slave girls that gets gifted to Cortes, and she gets married to one of the guys on the ship. She's baptized with the name Marina, and due to various mistranslations, she's now called Malinche. And why does she matter? Because she speaks both languages, the Maya language, the Aztec language, and she's very good at languages, and she quickly learned Spanish. Not only can she speak these languages, more importantly, she hates the Aztecs. She hates them because she was sold into slavery as a result of the Aztecs. So she brings the Aztecs to the last remaining independent force in the valley, and that is the Tlaxcalans, who had reached a very tense stalemate with the Aztecs. So Uncle Ian, every year they would fight the Flower Wars. So it's like a ritualized war where a limited number of men would be chosen to fight and die in these war games. So it's like a Mexican Hunger Games. They did this because both sides knew they couldn't afford to commit to a full-scale war. And so Malinche, she struck an alliance between the Spanish and the Tlaxcalans. And the Tlaxcalans, to celebrate this alliance, gave the Spanish a gift of slave girls. Human rights, not really a big element in this part of the world at this point in time. And they're saying, please, no more slave girls. We come here for gold, but we'll still take your slave girls. And from this point, the Tlaxcalans think they're using the Spanish, and the Spanish think they're using the Tlaxcalans, and I think they're both right.
One of the things Cortes had done was destroyed his ships. So his men had no option. They had to march on. It was a three-month march. Despite the fact that a lot of the tribes between the coast and Tenochtitlan saw the Spaniards as liberators from the fierce Aztecs, they'd got a bit sick of paying all this money to the Aztecs as tribute and seeing their people taken just to be sacrificed on the altar. So they did want to see that the Spaniards were their allies, but at the same time, Cortes wanted to appear to be fierce. So thousands of the local tribes people were slaughtered. By the time they reached Tenochtitlan, he had his 400 Spaniards, but 6,000 native allies, which is much closer to representing an army. Despite the fact that by definition, Tenochtitlan had a pretty sizable moat around it by having been built on a lake in the first place. The Spanish were fascinated. A city of 250,000, right across central Mexico, the population is estimated at 25 million, which is more than three times the size of Spain at the time. So the Spanish were overwhelmed with the scale of the civilization.
So Montezuma doesn't really know what to do. So he invites the Spanish in as guests, really. They're like two dogs sniffing each other's bums, just sussing each other out for a while. And Montezuma's like, look at my pile of skulls. And look at my very, very scary god whose skin has been turned inside out. And also he was thinking, these guys are really peculiar. They look great in my zoo. But the Spanish didn't want to be in the zoo. And the dynamic changed when the news arrived of the other Spanish rocking up by sea. And Cortes realizes that, oh no, they're going to arrest me. So they take Montezuma hostage.
They came to an agreement with Montezuma that you keep ruling and we won't kill you. He was held hostage for 6 months, as if he was appearing on the balcony waving to the people, but there's a Spaniard with a gun in his back, just like you see in the movies. At this time, the Spanish were busy introducing smallpox, and of course the locals had no immunity.
Pretty disastrous. I mean, probably the most disastrous outcome for the locals. I mean, as bad as everything else was.
Yeah.
In certain towns, it would be one in three people could die. To be fair on the Spanish, they didn't understand germs.
In June of 1520, Cortes had actually been down at the coast back at Veracruz. De Alvarez, in his place, had massacred a lot of the Aztecs, which provoked a significant response. The reason Cortes was in Veracruz was because he knew, as someone planning to conquer the Aztecs, he'd exceeded his authority because he was only meant to be there to trade.
Yeah, because Cortes was an outlaw at the time. His campaign to plunder gold, essentially, from the American mainland was a violation of the orders of the Cuban governor. And he initially got this permit to explore and trade with the mainland, but then the governor learned of his plans and then rescinded the permit. And so Cortes pretended to never have received the message and bribed the messenger to get on the boat and sailed off. It's like, sorry, governor, I can't hear you. I'm too busy plundering.
I didn't get the memo.
Yeah. And so Cortes, he hears of 800 Spaniards arriving on the coast and he chuffs off down there to defeat them in battle. And now all of a sudden he's got 800 more Spaniards to join up with his team. Then they go into this situation where the Spanish that were left in Tenochtitlan have committed this massacre. After the massacre, Cortes arrives back in Tenochtitlan and he takes Montezuma onto the roof of the palace. And Montezuma shouts, "We are not their match. The poor old men and women, the infants who toddle and crawl, are all suffering. We are not their match. Let everyone be dissuaded." Montezuma knew that more Spanish boats would come. And this realism was a part of a long Aztec tradition. The leaders were bound not to commit lives to wars they knew they could not win. That was the point of the Flower Wars. And so the Aztecs derided impulsive, reckless leaders as children, and Montezuma did not want to be that. Also, preventing a war might keep himself alive. But the locals were unconvinced. They pelted rocks at everyone on the roof. And it's now that Montezuma dies. He's either killed by his own people in the barrage of stones, or when Cortes realizes he's no longer useful and not really a valuable hostage, he kills him by putting a sword up his bum. Uncle Ian, which of those would you prefer?
I think you probably would go for the option that isn't a sword up your bum. You'd be looking for a third option, wouldn't you? At one stage in an episode of Get Smart, the great Maxwell Smart was once asked, "You are my prisoner, Mr. Smart, but I'm going to let you choose how you will die." And there's a gun and a vial of poison on the table. And so Maxwell Smart says, "I'd like to die of old age."
So Montezuma's dead. They realize they have to get out of this city because everyone is trying to kill them and they're trapped in a palace and they've just killed the emperor. And all the bridges are destroyed to stop them escaping. And they decide to build portable bridges and try to fight their way out. And two-thirds of them die trying to escape. They end up, the canals of Tenochtitlan are filled with drowned bodies and they run over the drowned bodies in order to escape.
Yeah.
Sadly, when they escaped Tenochtitlan, they had all the gold with them and it all fell into the canals. They were very upset.
That's why so many of them fell into the canals, because they were weighed down with it.
When they end up retaking the city, they sent all these people in to go and find it, but obviously they never did.
Mm.
It's buried under Mexico City now somewhere.
Hmm. I've got some flight credits.
We'll go looking.
We may not be the first to make that effort to dig back through 500 years. One of the other things to mention, when the Spaniards and the Aztecs came to combat, rifles and swords against the Aztec weapons, the Aztecs had made their blades of obsidian, which were designed to wound and thereby capture your opponent for sacrifice. They weren't actually designed to kill you on the battlefield. So that was a strategic disadvantage.
Very much so.
Because the Spanish weren't that interested in taking prisoners.
No. And Uncle Ian, do you remember the Texcoco heir that Montezuma had strangled?
Mm-hmm.
Well, his brothers also remember that. And they used the crisis to take over Texcoco and rebel against the Aztecs and join up with the Spanish. And as a result, 1 year later, Tenochtitlan is completely destroyed and the Spanish have taken over. So, that's the question I have for you. Do you think it was inevitable, or do you think Montezuma could have played his cards differently, and maybe the Aztec Empire is still going on and they're having debates at the UN about whether they should stop child sacrifice?
If you look at the local element, yeah, in hindsight, Montezuma could have led an alliance of all the local tribes if they hadn't pissed them off by taking all their money and sacrificing all their people. Mm. I think the answer, Scott, lies in what happened throughout the rest of Latin America.
Mm.
Whether it's the Incas, whether it's the Mayans, whether it's any of the other tribes all the way through the rest of the continent, it all gets colonized.
Yeah.
So I can't see any way that the Aztecs would have escaped that. A couple of things that it might be worth mentioning, Scott.
Mm.
In 1524, the Spaniards renamed the city of Tenochtitlan, which had shrunk from a population of 250,000 down to 30,000. That gives you an idea of the scale of destruction. They renamed the city after the original people and called it Mexico. And we know it today as Mexico City.
And they must have drained this lake that was there, because now Mexico City is massive, because this island's like 5 square kilometres. Mm.
It's also, I think, relevant, Scott, that we don't look at every Spaniard as being gold-hungry, bloodthirsty. Even during the 16th century, there were voices in Spain realising how harsh the conquest had been, not just of the Aztecs, but right throughout Latin America. And there was a Dominican friar, his name was Las Casas, and in 1552, he wrote a book called The Destruction of the Indies. And he referred to the conquistadors, and this is only 30 years on, he referred to the conquistadors as having been tyrants and thieves and ravenous wolves. So credit to him for having the courage of his religious convictions and trying to make sure that history knew how bloodthirsty the conquest was.
Even Columbus, who was also very ruthless, he had his moments where he realised that what he was doing was wrong. He was a very religious person, and on certain days came to see the areas he visited in the Americas as an Eden. And then he realised, well, if this is Eden, then I'm the snake.
I think from a European background, being Christian and civilized made you feel superior. And that happened in North America, South America, Africa, Asia, happened in Australia. So it doesn't make it right, but it wasn't just the people that we're talking about now. It was a European attitude.
By dunque, and that's the attitude of every colonizing party, the Persians, the Greeks, probably the Aztecs. The fact that we have the ability to do this to you means that you deserve that.
And arguably the Japanese felt that in the 1930s when they started colonising East Asia.
Oh, they weren't too fond of the Koreans, yeah.
Yeah, precisely.
The Romans were so, what would you say, pretentious, that they felt that the Germans didn't deserve to be colonised by them.
Yeah, they were too barbarian.
Hadrian's Wall in Scotland was built, was not to say we're going to prevent these people from invading delicate Roman territory. We're keeping these riffraff out of our nice country.
Just remember, Scott, you and I both descended from that riffraff.
I'm not suggesting. I'm not suggesting the Scottish are riffraff. I'll go on record, the Scottish are good people. Unqueen, let's take a quick break. When we come back, the President Porfirio Diaz. So, Unqueen, please tell us about President Porfirio Diaz.
So, Scott, before the break, we got to the Spanish conquest of Tenochtitlan and the beginning of Spanish colonization in Central America. The Spanish were pretty confident in being colonizers to the extent that they renamed the territory New Spain. Not very creative, but speaks volumes. So New Spain reached a long way up into what we now know as the southwestern USA and a long way down the Central American isthmus. For three centuries, Spain was the colonizing power. One of the things that changed that in the early 19th century was the geopolitical situation in Spain itself. Spain suffered greatly during the Napoleonic Wars, and it had a lot of difficulty in maintaining order in its colonies in the New World because of the destruction of its army in Spain itself as a subset of the Napoleonic Wars. And so this gave the locals right throughout the Spanish New World the opportunity to look for independence. And while it's outside the scope of this story, that's where Simon Bolivar comes in as the liberator of so many countries in South America. The Mexicans felt the same way. As early as 1810, Hidalgo had declared an independent Mexico. The Spanish took a while to agree to that, so they didn't officially become independent until 1821. Interestingly enough, they didn't become independent with a president, they became independent with an emperor. Although, unfortunately, to set the scene, after a year or two, they put him up against the wall and shot him.
Right.
The independent Mexico on the southern border of the United States, which at that stage was still very much an eastern part of the country, were always going to then start fighting for territory. Once the French moved away from their interests in the USA with the Louisiana Purchase, which is basically all the way up the Mississippi, had been French territory, sold that to the US. That left the US and New Spain having a common border. That resulted in a lot of competition for land, and in the mid-1830s, the key example that history remembers of that was the Battle for the Alamo. Shortly after that was the full-scale Mexican-American War in the late 1840s. Let's now introduce the character of Porfirio Diaz. Diaz came from Oaxaco. He was baptized, we don't actually know when he was born, baptized on the 15th of September 1830. He was of mestizo background, so that's combined Indian and European heritage. Very humble origin. When he was young, he became training for the priesthood. We've heard that a few times along the way, Scott, in our podcast.
Stalin.
He's a prime example, but he's certainly not the only one. So in 1846, the Mexican-American War broke out. Diaz joined the army, and one of the key factors that started the Mexican-American War was that it was time to fight over, was Texas American or Mexican? After the Battle of the Alamo, Texas had declared itself to be a republic, and the US were keen to integrate Texas into the United States, and the Mexicans were keen for that not to happen.
Who's living in Texas at this point? Is it Native Americans, or are there a lot of European settlers? What's going on?
There was still a very significant Native population, and a lot of people who were of Spanish background had moved north. The British colonists who'd settled in the east of the USA were still making their way west at that stage. The Texans, however, when they declared independence, didn't want to be either American or Mexican. They just wanted to be Texans. And maybe they still do.
Who do they declare independence from?
They declared independence from New Spain. They had been part of the territory that became independent Mexico. So the Mexican-American War ended in 1848. The Americans were victorious. And the countryside that we've mentioned, from California and Nevada right across to Texas on the Gulf, became US territory. Bearing in mind that Mexico had been independent for less than three decades, this was pretty humiliating to the Mexicans. Ironically, the Mexican general who signed the agreement, the treaty for the secession of this territory, was the same Santa Anna who'd been the victor at the Battle of the Alamo. This was during one of his several terms as president. Diaz, at this stage, was still looking at a military career.
he was encouraged to study law by a local official whose name was Benito Juarez. Juarez went on to become president in 1858 and continued to take an interest in Diaz's career. Juarez appointed Diaz to lead armies against the invading / occupying French troops in the 1860s.
The Battle of Pueblo in 1862, where Diaz leads this cavalry charge to win the battle, it's celebrated every year, Uncle Ian.
And rightly so.
On the 5th of May, Cinco de Mayo.
And as a result of that, Diaz was able to help Juarez regain the presidency after the fall of the Mexican emperor who ruled between 1864 and 1867.
Are we talking about Maximilian?
That's correct. So
Maximilian is the best.
So the story of Maximilian is absolutely fascinating. For those 3 years that I mentioned, the Habsburg Empire included Mexico. So, Scott, with your permission, we might just talk about Maximilian the Emperor for a little while.
Yeah, all right, let's get distracted.
So what was a Habsburg Austrian doing on the throne of Mexico?
Maybe it was a reed mat.
So Maximilian was the younger brother of Emperor Franz Joseph, who'd become Habsburg Emperor in 1848.
So this is of Austria-Hungary, Croatia, Slovenia, Slovakia, Czech Republic. They're a big Central European
all the
power.
Way up through what we now know as Poland. Huge Central and Eastern European Empire, that's correct. As the second son, once Franz Joseph had a child, Maximilian didn't expect to become emperor of anywhere. He was a diplomat on behalf of his brother. He did get a royal marriage, and one of my favourite facts about Maximilian was that he was married to Charlotte, who was the daughter of Leopold of Belgium. Leopold of Belgium, of course, wasn't Belgian at all. He was a Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, the first king of independent Belgium. And by virtue of being the daughter of Leopold, that meant that Charlotte was the first cousin of both Queen Victoria and of Prince Albert. Just such a beautiful insight into 19th century dynastic politics.
Well, Maximilian thought that the Belgian royalty was scum because they were only invented a year before his birth.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And they didn't have this century-old lineage like his parents.
I know. But, yeah, as far as we can see, he and Charlotte were very happy together. Still doesn't tell us how come he ended up in Mexico. Enter the French Emperor, Napoleon III.
The nephew of the actual Napoleon.
The nephew and step-grandson.
What?
Napoleon III was indeed Napoleon's nephew, but was also Josephine's grandson, because Napoleon's brother married Josephine's daughter from her first marriage. So Josephine couldn't have children with Napoleon, but already had children from her first marriage.
Right, yeah.
So Napoleon's brother married his brother's stepdaughter. The child of that marriage was Napoleon III, who in the late 1840s, largely on the strength of his name, rose to become Prime Minister, then President, then Emperor.
He did a very Napoleonic thing and committed a coup against himself and took over his own government.
Exactly right. So, back to Maximilian. In the early 1860s, Mexico was financially unstable. They were unable to keep up payments of their foreign debt to the British, the French, and the Spanish. Napoleon III took this pretty seriously and decided that it was because it was these newfangled liberal Democrats like Juarez who were in power who were stopping the payment of the debts that were owed to the French people. He thought it would be a good idea to make Mexico into an empire and find some Catholic who would be happy to be on the throne.
Oh, because they invented this term that we still use of Latin America. It's like, oh, well, they're Catholic and they're not Anglo-Saxon. They're in the Latin-speaking world. Therefore, the French should have influence there.
Correct. Originally, Maximilian was offered the throne in 1861. Key date in North American history, because that's when the US Civil War started. And therefore, the US was a bit distracted.
Because they've got the Monroe Doctrine, they're not letting the French just come in and take over half of Mexico.
That's right. So the Monroe Doctrine, after an earlier president of the US, was basically the Western Hemisphere can look after itself. We don't want any more colonizing powers. Maximilian didn't expect to inherit the throne of Austria-Hungary because his older brother had already had a son. The fact that Rudolf killed himself a couple of decades later in a suicide pact with his 17-year-old mistress is a separate story all of its own. By April of 1864, Maximilian allowed himself to be convinced that the Mexicans really wanted him on the throne. There's no independent analysis of the referendum by which the Mexicans voted to ask Maximilian to be their emperor, but nonetheless, when he read it in the paper, he realised it must have been true. So Maximilian arrives with Charlotte, who's now called Carlotta, in May of 1864. They make their way up to Mexico City.
Hold on. Are you going to say how they get to Mexico City? Uncle, they don't just get to Mexico City. They arrive in Mexico with hundreds of pieces of luggage, including pool tables and an orchestra conductor. That's what you need when you get to Mexico. So he's wearing, of course, thick layers of Austrian fabric in the latest fashion. And he's picked up and taken to Mexico City on a mule. And he spends his reign mostly at war, doesn't he?
Unfortunately, yes. He was only going to be able to stay as an emperor as long as the French were prepared to support him. He wasn't worried about that because Napoleon III had given him his word. That's why there were 30,000 French troops in Mexico supporting Maximilian's reign.
One thing about Maximilian, I should say, is he wasn't very useful as a wartime leader. He spent most of his reign at war, and he spent most of his reign writing a book, 500 pages, about the etiquette that should be followed in court. And he would be at battles leading the troops, and then he'd get distracted by a butterfly and wander off.
That's fine until April 1865, the end of the US Civil War. Suddenly the US is interested in what happens on its borders again. Napoleon III got very nervous about, and the US pressured Napoleon III to withdraw his troops, which he did in early 1867. Maximilian felt very let down, realised his position was untenable, tried to abdicate, put it to a vote of his royal council. They voted that he should stay. Carlotta went to Paris to meet Napoleon III and to Rome to meet the Pope to beg support. She was unsuccessful.
Well, she has a nervous breakdown.
That's exactly right.
Well, because she goes to visit the Pope and she tells the Pope, everyone's trying to kill me. Napoleon's going to have me poisoned. All the people in my entourage, they're trying to poison me. And the Pope says, maybe go home and see your family.
And she got to a stage where she was telling her attendants that there had to be a chicken in the room and she would only eat eggs that came from that chicken. She had to watch them being laid by the chicken and had to watch them being cooked in front of her because she was so scared about being poisoned.
I have the exact same policy at home.
And she ended up staying in Europe, stayed with her Belgian relatives, ended up living in Paris for a long time, died in 1927. So, Maximilian, we've got to give him credit for his bravery. By the time the French withdrew, it was pretty inevitable because Benito Juarez is still keen on regaining power. And Maximilian did lead an army against Juarez's forces, but he was betrayed. And on the 15th of May in 1867, he was captured. There was a show trial. Juarez ignored pleas from various European powers and from the US itself for clemency for Maximilian. He decided that the only way to end this mockery of empire was that the emperor had to die. On the 19th of June, 1867, they put Maximilian up against the wall along with two of his loyal generals and shot them.
I know you like an obituary quote, Uncle Ian, and Maximilian, I think, has written his own obituary quote when he said, I should not have come here.
Brief, to the point, accurate. So, we're back with Diaz.
Maximilian's dead. We're back to Diaz.
Maximilian's dead. Juarez returns to power in 1867, becomes president, and Diaz goes back to the farm, leaves the army. Juarez is up for re-election in 1871. At that stage, Diaz decides that he does like having some authority, and he's not very keen on this concept of re-election. He thinks there should be opportunities for lots of different people to become president and to serve in high office.
So he doesn't want the president being able to be re-elected.
Correct. Yeah, he feels very strongly about that during the 1870s. So strongly that he led protests against his old patron Juarez, who ended up being re-elected in 1871, but then died in 1872. I don't think we know that his death was suspicious. It was convenient. Next up was Lerdo, who became president after Juarez. Diaz wasn't that keen on him either. And eventually, Diaz got himself elected president in 1877.
He defeated the government forces in battle. That's November of 1876. And then the following May, he was formally elected president. It's always concerning when you take control of the government and then win an election. It really should be the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the word we haven't used yet in this context is reluctant as well.
He keeps saying how reluctant he is.
But let's find out how reluctant he continued to be. The next election is due in 1880. Diaz was as good as his word. He didn't run for re-election. He handpicked a successor, General Manuel González, who was duly elected president in 1880. You find that González presidency quite interesting in terms of what Diaz was doing behind the scenes.
He didn't. He picks this guy to be his replacement and then forces him to pass unpopular legislation so that he can pretend to reluctantly run for president again and save the country from this incompetent person who he's forcing to be there.
Reluctantly, in 1884, Diaz allows himself to be convinced to stand for president again and was duly re-elected for what we could call another batch of terms, or we could call one single term of 26 years.
One historian said that he had regular elections that were regularly defrauded.
So, but some observations. Diaz appointed his family and his friends, including his father-in-law, to high office. He took control of the press and the courts. The Catholic Church retained their freedom only by being totally independent. They didn't get involved in social or political issues during the reign of Diaz. One third of the population was of Indian background. He just ignored them because they weren't in Mexico City. So they were out in the provinces and he was not interested in their welfare.
It's interesting because he himself is half-half.
That's right. But by then, he was very much ensconced in the aristocratic life of Mexico City. Mm. Now, after all the external wars and the internal wars, Mexico was broke. So Diaz encouraged foreign investment, which did help build railways, bridges. They opened up mines. They built irrigation infrastructure. But only the wealthy and the foreign investors profited. The rural population was living in poverty. They were virtually enslaved. And this went on for year after year, for decade after decade, for electoral term after electoral term.
Well, you had that whole concept of the bread and the stick, which is the bread goes to the people who support him and the stick goes to everybody else.
Yeah. And he was quite happy to use the local police or the local militia. They were called the rurales to enforce his style of justice. Now, remember, by this time, he's well into his 70s. So the people around him were getting a bit worried about the succession, whether it would be peaceful or whether it would be violent. We know it turned out to be violent. But I think one of the clues lies in Mexican history. Because when Diaz became the president, Mexico had been independent for barely 50 years. Not counting the time when they had emperors and royal councils running the show, Diaz was the 33rd president in that time.
Didn't they have 50 changes of presidency in 30 years?
Yes, backwards and forwards, liberals, conservative, and yet of the people who were genuinely called president, in half a century, Diaz was number 33. Hardly stable.
No. And there were people who were president multiple times in that as well.
That's right. By 1908, all the talk was about how long is Diaz going to continue as president. He actually gave an interview to an American journalist.
It went well and then it very much didn't.
He then claimed that he wanted the next election to be open and free.
He said that just because he had an American audience. Americans love democracy. This will go down well.
Correct. What was also in his mind was that 1910 was going to be the centenary of Hidalgo's Declaration of Mexican Independence, and Diaz wanted to be part of that. So he was outwardly happy for Francisco Madero, who was an aristocrat but was pledging democratic reform, to challenge him for the presidency. That duly happened. Lo and behold, Diaz was re-elected by quite a considerable margin.
Was that after Madero was arrested?
Yes.
It certainly helps.
Yeah, it does. And so Madero claimed the election was corrupt. Madero decided that he should head north for his safety.
Because he escaped the prison.
Yes. However, and this is partially because of Madero travelling through the countryside, he's picking up followers along the way who all realised that the 80-year-old Diaz was well and truly past his time. And there were local riots breaking out, and eventually Diaz's position became untenable. He and Madero made an agreement that Diaz would resign on the 25th of May, 1911. Diaz then went into exile, moved to Paris, a bit of a common theme, remembering that 50 years prior he'd been fighting against the French, died on the 2nd of July, 1915, at the age of 84.
Before he died, he gave a very ominous quote, which is still recalled today. He says about Madero, "He has unleashed a tiger, let's see if he can ride it." And Madero proves to be incapable of riding the tiger because he himself is killed. The Revolutionary Wars go on for 10 years.
And there's a lot of characters in that Revolutionary War who suffer a similar fate. Scott, as you've mentioned, I do love a good obituary notice. The New York Times noted, in capital letters, "No friends at bedside."
That's very harsh.
Now, July 1915, Paris, there was a war on. So there's an argument.
He's also far from home.
But they put it in capital letters in the headline.
Jeez, that's very harsh.
Yeah. New York Times also said that he was an old and broken man watching the country sink into anarchy. Now, Scott, I don't think we've reached the lofty heights of quoting the Pennsylvania Sentinel that said his word was absolute.
Except if he said that he was going to ban presidents from being re-elected.
During the 1870s, his word was absolute in that space. But
well, Madero actually copied his campaign slogan because the campaign slogan was "no re-election." And so Madero used that against him 30 years later. Mm-hmm. I think that's fantastic.
It is. It's excellent. I'm tempted, Scott, to have a look at Dictator Bingo and we'll see where Diaz stacks up. Firstly, we look at his photographs. Very distinctive moustache. Training for the priesthood.
Yeah.
Turns the tables on his patron. Tries to retire and then reluctantly decides to put himself at the disposal of the country. He's got the secret police force, the rurales. We've got the mock elections. We've got the played favourites with his family and friends being in parliament, being in key government jobs. He did like a uniform. He did like wearing his medals. Scott, I'm going to be honest, and I don't know if his defamation lawyers are listening to the podcast. I don't like him, but from a Dictator Bingo point of view, it's all there. How much of a judgment do you think we can make, Scott, as to who's the biggest, baddest, meanest?
Montezuma sacrifices thousands and thousands of people. You know, he's ripping out their hearts. If a 20th century dictator was ripping out thousands of people's hearts and was involved in the ceremony, we would say this guy is the most vicious dictator we've seen. But because he's from another culture and from another time, we give him a bit of grace. Is that right? Is that wrong? Or should we judge him for what he did? Or should we put him in the context of the culture?
I think you're right. There's a context to it. We haven't had one like this before, have we?
They're just so different. And the cultures are so different.
They are.
How about this? This might help you make up your mind, maybe. Okay. Or maybe it'll make things harder for you.
Okay.
Diaz had his political opponent arrested. Montezuma had him strangled.
Yeah, that's pretty decisive.
The problem is that the dictator bingo has a distinctly 20th century flavour that Diaz kind of fits into. Human sacrificing was not a dictator bingo feature.
Are you suggesting that Diaz planned some of his characteristics with dictator bingo in mind?
It does seem that way, because he ticks all those boxes, but he doesn't have the sex appeal that Montezuma has.
Diaz only had two wives and not at the same time.
Yeah, and Montezuma had 100 kids. He's obviously got some sex appeal.
Yeah.
Let's use the tried and true criteria. We've got three. Biggest, baddest, meanest.
Yep.
Historically significant. And dictator bingo.
Mm.
Diaz wins dictator bingo, hands down.
Oh, yes.
Historically significant, Montezuma. Oh, but he lost.
But the fact is, more than 500 years after his death, we're still talking about Montezuma. Let's get rid of Diaz. Let's go with Montezuma.
Are you sure? You seem very uncertain.
I am. I acknowledge I'm uncertain, but I see your point about historical significance. Through him, we remember Aztec culture.
Montezuma, congratulations. You remain in the tournament to be named history's biggest dictator. So, what's happening next week? Next episode?
Next episode, Scott, I think we should go back to Africa and we will look at someone who I'm calling our first absentee dictator.
This is a clue. You mentioned his namesake in today's episode.
I have. Yes, you're right. That's a very good clue.
All right, Aquilian. So to force us to get to work, we will record this. I'm telling the listeners because they keep emailing me. They keep sending me messages saying, when's the next episode? The next episode we'll record on April 10th. Thank you for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. We'll see you in Africa very soon.
Thanks, Scott.